get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas. We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. Automobiles have been a staple of popular culture over the last half century. There's something uniquely American about road trip films and car chases, and many have looked at car movies as naturally evolving from the Western genre. Why is it so appealing to stick characters in a car and have them embark on adventures? What are some of the more iconic films and television shows featuring automobiles? Today's show is part one of a two-part discussion, and returning as my guest is freelance writer and cultural critic Leonard Pierce, whose blog can be found at ludikid.com. The Automobile on Screen, up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today on the show we'll be talking about the automobile in popular culture. From road trip adventures to car chases, automobiles have served as a major component in American films and television shows over the years. And joining me in my discussion today is freelance writer and pop culture critic Leonard Pierce. Welcome back to the show, Leonard.
It's great to be back. It's been a long time.
It has. Leonard has written for a number of publications about music, film, and culture. His website can be found at www.ludikid.com. That's ludikid.com. And you're covering the Conservative Political Action Conference next February?
In February. It's going to be an election year, CPAC, this year, so there will be a lot of candidates there, and it should be a good time.
Well, you're covering it for,
For Sadly No, that's correct. Yeah, it's generally a left-wing political humor site.
So, I thought of a topic of cars and film recently while watching the 1971 film Duel, which was Steven Spielberg's directorial debut. And it's a movie about a mild-mannered businessman played by Dennis Weaver who's terrorized by a tanker truck while driving through California. And it's this cat-and-mouse chase where you never actually see the truck driver, so the truck itself assumes the role of the villain. Getting to the general subject of automobiles in pop culture, what is it about cars and roads that make them very compelling environments for storytelling?
Well, the cliche in this case is a true one. It's all about freedom. You know, the car to America represents freedom of movement. It represents a sort of anonymity. Anyone can get in a car and go anywhere. The very idea of our sense of freedom to travel and the fact that we're such a physically huge country means that we developed this car culture in a very unique way, the way that it didn't really develop in Europe, because Europe is much smaller. You know, there's not as much space to travel in, and so they developed a sort of railroad culture and not a car culture, and so we developed in that particular way, and it's very bound up in our whole notion of personal freedom, our whole notion of the ability to, you know, get up and change our lives with the drop of a hat, you know, just get in the car and drive away and start a new life somewhere. And I remember reading somewhere very recently, and I wish I could recall where, that the writer was attempting to talk about what was very unique to the American culture, and he says the two things that forged the character of America more than anything else in the modern era were handguns and automobiles. And if you look at contemporary film, those are the two things that are the most present in movies, is handguns and automobiles.
Do you see car movies, automobile movies, as the direct descendant of Westerns? You know, instead of a cowboy on his horse, dealing with desperados, dealing with outlaws, you mentioned before, you kind of have that frontier American culture. It's very unique to this country. Is that kind of just, dealing with cars and highways and roads, just a natural next step, next progression?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost a complete analog, you know, a direct expression of the growth of the frontier. You know, the frontier is gone, and the ability to discover new and exciting lands to the west is a thing of the past, but the philosophical foundation of it is still there, the idea that you can, you know, the one man, the loner, who can hop in his car and head off into the distance and find new adventures and new places, new encounters and, you know, excitement and action and all those cinema tropes, it lives on in the automobile. And in a way, it's even developed in a more existential sense, you know, because since the actual frontier is gone, since the lack of knowledge of what lays beyond is gone, the road has become more of a metaphor than ever. You know, it's more of a, it's turned into a sort of spiritual or psychological journey rather than a physical one to discover what's new in the West. It's to discover what's new in yourself.
Can you give me examples of films that have dealt with that sort of angle?
Yeah, in fact, this is an ideal time to be talking about it because just last week, Monty Hellman's Two Lane Blacktop was released in a Criterion Collection DVD. And it came out, I believe, in 1971, and it gained a sort of cult following almost immediately after it was released. Esquire and Rolling Stone both declared that it was their movie of the year, and this turned out to be kind of an embarrassment because the executive who was in charge of the film company that released it thought it was terrible, and he didn't give it any marketing, and so it turned out to be a huge flop at the box office, and it sort of faded out of existence. But it was really highly praised at the time, and ever since then, when it gets an occasional DVD or video release, it always sort of rekindles that praise because it's a very unique film, and a lot of people call it the first movie of the 70s, not in a literal sense, but in a sort of metaphorical sense, that it's the first of that wave of kind of auteur-driven 70s films, and it's really just an existential car chase. It's a three nameless people involved in a cross-country road trip for no particular reason that they can articulate. They just get in their cars and drive and drive and drive and drive endlessly over these amazing, quiet, long shots of freeway. And it's got Warren Oates in the lead role. Nobody in the film has a name. They're just known by their titles. The driver, the mechanic, and then Warren Oates plays a guy called GTO because that's the car that he drives. He plays this guy who, he's an older guy who drives a GTO, and he doesn't really ever let you know who he really is. Every time he encounters someone, he tells them a different story about who he is and who he is racing against and where he came from. And that sort of represents the whole freedom of the road, that, you know, when you're out on the road and driving from place to place, nobody knows who you are, and you can make yourself into anybody you want. And then the two guys he's racing against are played by James Taylor and Brian Wilson, the rock stars. It's the only movie either one of them made, and they play these two kids that Warren Oates is racing against. And it's just a really kind of an amazing film. There isn't anything like it, but it's really the pinnacle of that sort of existential road movie. And there would be a lot more of them throughout the 70s. There was sort of a mini wave of them. There was, of course, Easy Rider, and Electric Light and Blue, Vanishing Point. There were quite a few of those sort of, you know, existential road trip movies that came around in the 70s.
Well, the road trip, there have been countless numbers of films that kind of kick off with the road trip. You just throw a whole bunch of characters in the car and get them going someplace. Ultimate destination, it might not be entirely critical to the story, but the interaction between the characters that takes place while they're en route, that's what's important. And why is that? Something that's it's really entertaining to watch, just throwing a whole bunch of characters and have them converse in a car as opposed to sitting around, a dinner table, coffee table, or what have you.
Well, I think it's partly because if you want to develop characters and really get into an intense situation where you can really reveal people's characters and tease out secrets about them from a dramatic angle, there's nothing better than putting them in an enclosed space. You know, that's why you see so many of these sort of what they call in theater the closed room drama. But it opens up a lot more dramatic possibility from there, even if you make that small enclosed space moving, because it leaves open the possibility of interference from the outside, of danger, of meeting new characters, of having a crisis erupt, which you're just not going to get from sitting around a dinner table. You know, you're not going to have any kind of outside influences bear down on the situation unless something very unusual happens. So, you know, you have a whole sort of, Roger Ebert actually wrote an interesting essay about this quite a while back, about how there's all these little genres of people traveling somewhere in a closed conveyance. You know, there's Stagecoach, the classic John Wayne film, which is a road movie in a stagecoach. You've got, you know, Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, which is it's on a train. And you have a lot of films like that are on boats. But there's never been as rich a genre for them as being in cars, because, you know, that's just such a big part of American culture and of American film culture. And, you know, people love to drive and people love to see the vastness of America and the potential of America. And there's no better way to see that than in a car, you know, driving across the country. And you also have to consider that Los Angeles, where, you know, Hollywood is a big car town as well. It's a place where everybody drives, and that influences the people who live there, and it influences the way that they work and the way that they write. And so you see that reflected back in the films themselves. So it's just really a great dramatic device, and the reality of American culture and the size of America and the way that Americans are so involved with their cars as objects and as aesthetic objects as well as practical ones means that you're never going to see an end to the road trip movie. It's always going to be the favorite way of getting a couple of people together and revealing things about their character while they're on their way to something or on their way to some place that they may never get.
A few points here. Well, you mentioned Ebert's essay about drawing clear distinction between, say, the road trip movies on automobiles versus ones on a train. You mentioned Murder on the Orient Express. There's also Strangers on a Train, the Alfred Hitchcock classic film. See, I kind of thought of those types of stories as being very similar. You know, whether it's you're talking about Before Sunrise, the Richard Linklater film, where they're kind of Ethan Hawke and Julie Temple on a train, and even taking, like, the Millennium Falcon in Star Wars, you know, outer space, you know, the beginning of Star Wars, Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, they get on this ship with Obi-Wan, and they kind of bond there in that voyage. And then, again, with Princess Leia and Han Solo in Empire Strikes Back. And I think also, I remember it was either George Lucas or maybe the director of Empire Strikes Back had talked about the fact that they'd originally envisioned the Millennium Falcon as this kind of old clunky automobile where things are always breaking down and Han Solo and Chewbacca always have to put things back together. So you kind of see that as being very different from your traditional, from a, like your typical road trip auto movie? Or do you see a lot of similarities there?
I think the essential difference between a car road trip movie or journey movie, if you want to call it that, and one that uses a train or a plane or a ship, although not a spaceship, is that a train is only going to go one place. You know where a train is going to go, and you know how it's going to get there. And that's not necessarily the case with a boat or a plane, but generally there's not that complete freedom of movement with a plane or a ship that there is with a car. You know, a car can go anywhere, and when people set out on a road trip, they might end up someplace completely different than they meant to start out, a completely different way. There are a million possibilities when you start out on a road trip of where you're going to go, how you're going to get there, and where you're going to end up. And that's, you know, of course, that transfers to the idea of a spaceship quite well. So, you know, that's a neatly turned metaphor on Lucas's part. But, you know, if you look at, for example, the classic film noirs, you know, there's a sort of legendary film noir called Detour, which is about a hitchhiker who's, you know, winding his way from the East Coast to the West Coast and meeting with all sorts of hapless misadventures along the way. He's, you know, he meets up with this fearsome femme fatale, and he's falsely accused of murder, and all sorts of terrible things go wrong. And he ends up in a succession of terrible situations, and he never gets anywhere close to where he's trying to go. And that's the sort of thing that really couldn't happen on a train because it doesn't have that broad vista of possibility. You know, the fact that he's in a succession of cars constantly moving farther away from where he's trying to go gives it that sort of existentialist, you know, dark edge to it that you rarely see in any other kind of conveyance movie. And I think that's not a coincidence. I think that, as we talked about at the top of the show, the fact that the car represents freedom, it also represents the dark side of freedom. It represents the danger of too much liberty and the fact that it can sort of turn into a nightmare if it goes too far, which, you know, a train which just goes from point A to point B can't really communicate that as a metaphor quite as easily.
I think you also have the isolation element on roads, where you don't have that in a train. Obviously, you've always got a million people around and the conductors and an atmosphere full of outsiders. Whereas in a car, you're by yourself, car breaks down, you know, what happens? There's a lot of films that deal with this kind of thing, you know, where Breakdown was a Kurt Russell film in the late 90s, where his car breaks down on the road and... He leaves his wife with a truck driver. He never sees the wife again, and he embroils in this huge chase adventure. There have been other films. I mean, you mentioned Hitchhiking. There was the Hitcher, the horror movie that came out in the mid-80s with Rucker Hauer that was remade, actually, recently.
Remade in a terrible version. Really a very bad movie, the remake was. But, you know, another thing very similar to what you're talking about is that in terms of character development, if you're on a train or especially on a boat, and to a lesser extent, an airplane, you can always get away to a certain degree from somebody that you're with, whereas in a car, you're never going to have that many people in a car. And so if you stick two people in a car, there's going to be some dramatic situation developed there because there's nowhere to go. You know, it's just the two of them, and one of them can't get out. So, you know, there's in terms of just, you know, ramping up the dramatic conflict, they sort of can't avoid each other the way that they can in another conveyance. They're in this very small area together, and there's nothing for them to do other than either ignore each other or talk to each other. And so it's a good breeding ground for dramatic situation as well from that standpoint.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined today by Leonard Pierce, and you're listening to Under Surveillance, and we're talking about the automobile in popular culture, about the different themes involved with automobile films, and we're also going to talk about television shows as well, too, most notable auto films over the last few decades, and switching the gears a little bit and turning to television, you know, we have a few iconic car-related TV shows. Maybe not the greatest in terms of entertainment, but certainly incredibly popular when they were out, when they were released. One is Knight Rider, came out in the early 80s, and also very apropos to talk about it now because they're remaking Knight Rider as a feature film next year. And I'm not sure who the lead is going to be. I know David Hasselhoff is supposed to have a cameo. But Knight Rider featuring David Hasselhoff as this crime fighter named Michael Knight. But he's got this crazy souped-up car named Kit, K-I-T-T, that they managed to perfect artificial intelligence and instill it in this car. And the car talks to Michael and kind of sounds a little bit like a butler. It comments on the popularity of Knight Rider. Does that come stem more from America's infatuation with robots at the time more than cars?
Yeah, that was really an expression of technology. But of course, you know, the American infatuation with new technology and the American infatuation with cars have always gone hand in hand. So it's not really surprising that it developed the way that it did. One of the interesting things, I don't know if you've heard this, but you know, of course, the original voice of Kit was William Daniels, who was best known at that time for being on St. Elsewhere. And he has a very mannered sort of transatlantic voice. You know, as you said, he sort of sounds like a butler. You know, he has that sort of almost ingratiating, you know, pleasant tone to the way he speaks. And the person who's going to be giving Kit's voice in the remake is Will Arnett, who is best known for playing Job on Arrested Development.
That's right.
And he, you know, it couldn't be more different because, you know, of course, his character on that show was very aggressive and sort of arrogant and cocky and self-assured. And, you know, that's a complete turnaround from the way that Kit was characterized and voiced on the old show. So I kind of wonder if they're going to be going for the remake as camp, you know, or sort of a just comedic, you know, take on the whole idea. But yeah, that was a period in which there was a lot of car fetishism from the late 70s to the early 80s. It was a very fertile period of car fetishism on television. You know, they started with the Starsky and Hutch car, which is still very iconic, the Knight Rider Kit car, and then you also had the A-Team van, which was very popular at the time, and just a lot of very you know, and that's also the same time the Smokey and the Bandit films came out, so you had the iconic car from that film as well.
Well, actually, before Knight Rider, before Kit, you had all those souped-up cars from all the James Bond films, right? You had the cars with the oil slicks, the Spy Who Loved Me, the car turned into a boat and had a rocket launcher as well, too. You have the Aston Martin, right, from Goldfinger, that was a famous car.
Now, the Aston Martin Corporation always said that, you know, the James Bond movies doubled their sales because it was so popular, you know, that particular type of car, you know, a lot of people bought it who probably had never even heard of it before then.
And after Knight Rider, there was a TV show called Nighthawk, which had a souped-up motorcycle. There was a film that turned into a TV series called Blue Thunder, about a souped-up helicopter. None of those had personalities. They didn't have artificial intelligence installed in the machines, but it's still kind of the same type of, as you mentioned before, infatuation with technology. Another iconic TV series, which I've never understood the appeal of whatsoever, The Dukes of Hazzard, immensely popular for a brief period of time in the 80s, featuring the General Lee as this car with no doors. I never understood that either. I guess it was a racing car, stock car, that would just get involved in car chases with the police in every episode, from what I gathered. Any thoughts on The Dukes of Hazzard?
Well, that's, you know, I wish that a friend of mine was here today talking to you, because he wrote a book called Hick Flicks, and it was all about the rise and fall of redneck cinema and just images of iconic, you know, hillbilly exploitation from the 60s until, you know, the 80s. And he has quite a bit to say about the appeal of The Dukes of Hazzard. I never quite understood it myself either, but it was hugely popular, and... you know, you cannot talk about cars in films without talking about car chases, because they're just an unbelievably popular feature of car movies, and they're as loved by the general public as they are hated by critics. You know, the car chase is one of the tropes of film that almost every movie critic, myself included, just absolutely despises. It's a cheap way of padding out the running time of your movie. It doesn't accomplish anything. It's just the cheapest of cheap thrills, but the public tends to not be able to get enough of them. You know, whether they're artfully done or whether they're really cliched and dumb, the public has always really gone for car chases, and, you know, Dukes of Hazzard was nothing but wall-to-wall car chases for most of every episode, and so it really struck a nerve with the people who like that sort of thing.
Well, see, I don't know if I agree with you. I mean, there was a Dukes of Hazzard film that came out, I guess it was a year or so ago. But in general, you couldn't do that kind of show today, though. I don't think the public would buy that for one second. We don't really have those kinds of shows today. I think for someone to put a car chase on screen, it's got to be totally over the top, incredible. Otherwise, people have just seen too many of them, I think, over the years.
I'm not sure if I agree with you there. I mean, look at how many car chase movies have been really popular in the last few years. You know, the Gone in 60 Seconds was very popular, and then the... you know, I've completely blanked on the name of the films, but there's a very popular series of car chase movies that just came out. I think they just...
Oh, was it Fast and the Furious? Was that it?
Very popular series of film. I mean, every one of them made a fortune at the box office, and none of them were any good, you know, at least from my perspective, but they made a ton of movies, or they made a ton of money, and that indicates to me that the public has not gotten its fill of car chase movies.
Well, okay, but maybe on television, though. I mean, with a film, you've got a lot more money. You can kind of you can go over the top and do, you know, all sorts of crazy stunts. But maybe a show like Dukes of Hazzard, you mean, the guy, what'd you have? You had the main character was Uncle Jesse, had a moonshine business. You're always trying to run away from the cops each episode. I mean, that kind of thing week in and week out. Is there any kind of just a general car chase weekly TV series on today?
No, there's not. And in fact, the only show that I can think of that had anything like that recently was the series that was very quickly canceled. It was written by one of the veterans of Joss Whedon's production company. I think it was called Drive. It was on Fox for about 6 episodes, and it was canceled very quickly. The public just did not have a taste for it. But, you know, I don't know. I think that they have not quite lost their taste for the car chase genre. I think they've just transferred it to the big screen where they can get more bang for their buck. And, you know, the fact that it's not on TV right now, I don't think that's really indicative of anything, because every time there's not a lot of sitcoms that are very popular, everyone says that America has grown up and grown out of its taste for the sitcom, and, you know, yet again, every couple of years, sitcoms become very huge again. So I would not be surprised if sometime in the next few years we see, we see car chase movies, car chase TV shows make a resurgence. And after all, you know, I mean, look at NASCAR. It's more popular than ever, and demolition derbies are more popular than ever, and, you know, the monster truck shows are more popular than ever. So maybe they're just getting their fix somewhere else other than television.
That's very true. I've never understood the appeal of NASCAR either, to be honest, and I'm a big sports fan, but, you know, auto racing, it's something that's really never caught on with me. But, I guess there's regional, cultural, maybe disconnect with the South and the rest of the country. I don't know.
I think that may have been the case at one point, but NASCAR is huge outside of the South now. I mean, you have NASCAR tracks everywhere in the country now, and they're all making a ton of money. It's the most popular sport in the country after football right now, I believe. You know, I mean, Chicago has a NASCAR track, and, New England has NASCAR tracks. It's popular everywhere, and I don't know if that's just a reaction to it's sort of become trendy and that, you know, people in other parts of the country have taken to it, because it certainly did used to have the reputation as being a purely hillbilly, you know, southern sport, but that's certainly not the case anymore.
Actually, I was thinking of, what was it, Days of Thunder? There was a Tom Cruise racing movie. There's also wasn't there a Stallone racing movie that came out not too long ago?
Yeah, I believe it was. I can't recall the name of it, but, you know, just recently there's been a lot of stock car movies, and, you know, even to the point that there's been parodies of them. There was the Will Ferrell.
It was Talladega Nights, I think, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Anytime a genre has become popular enough that it spawns its own parody, you know, it's sort of arrived.
The next episode of Under Surveillance will take place on January 9th, where I'll be discussing the presidential primaries with Loyola Professor Alan Gittleson. But Leonard and I will resume our conversation on January 23rd, where we'll talk about a number of classic horror films. For Leonard Pierce, I'm Kevin Fulham, and for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's undersurveillance.org.